Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Dame Daphne Sheldrick is the first person to successfully raise infant elephants. The elephants end up at Tsavo National Park, the protected area her late husband built. A new film, Born to be Wild 3D, documents Dame Sheldrick's work. It also features the work of renowned primatologist Dr. Birute Marigaldicus, who raises orphaned orangutans born in Borneo. Joining us in the studio, Dr. Dame Daphne Sheldrick of the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, and Drew Fellman, the writer and producer of Born to be Wild 3D, and want to let you know you can watch a trailer of Born to be Wild and clips from the film of Dame Daphne and Dr. Birute's animal orphanages at our website at drshow.org. You'll also find links on our site to the two organizations and a 60 Minutes piece about Dame Daphne's work. Now, you can join us at 800-433-8850. Join us by email, send us a tweet, or on Facebook. Good morning to both of you. It's lovely to have you here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Drew Fellman, tell me what led you to want to tell the story of these two women.
Sure. Well, for me, the origins kind of go way back. I actually came upon the orangutan project first about 17 years ago as I was just traveling through Southeast Asia. But the thing that was really remarkable to me about it that made it stand out is that, you know, there's this enterprise happening in both locations where people and animals are working together as equals, you know, on this, you know, great enterprise to, you know, rescue these orphans and give them a second chance at life. And it's just something really remarkable to see, and we thought it really deserved to be up on the big screen.
How long did it take you to create the film?
Well, I think we got our green light about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. So from go until screen time, it was about 18 months.
Well, I congratulate you.
But it was, of course, like anything, many more years before that.
Of course. Dame Daphne, I have seen you in this film. I have seen your love, your caring for these elephants. Tell me how it all began for you now 50 years ago.
Well, I'm born in Kenya, grew up on a highland farm that was full of wild animals in those days, had my first little orphaned antelope when I was 3 years old. So it was when I married into the wildlife service and went to live in Tsavo National Park with my husband that I had to deal with the bigger orphans, things like buffalo, rhinos, and, of course, the elephants. And the elephants were the greatest challenge for me.
Why?
They're very, very fragile in early infancy, and I think our organization is the first ever to successfully raise newborn elephants. We've raised two from the day they were born, and over 200 have passed through our hands now. Many have lived, but a lot haven't. They come in very damaged, fragile, psychologically disturbed, having lost their elephant mother and elephant family, because the family is the most important thing in an elephant's life, just as it is to us humans.
You saw that as well, Drew.
Oh, absolutely.
The importance of family.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing that's so incredibly extraordinary is it's really a joint effort, especially with the elephants, between people and elephants. The elephants will live until they're 2 years old at a nursery that the Sheldricks run just outside Nairobi. But once they're two, they move to sort of a halfway house in Tsavo National Park. It's a stockade out there where they live sort of under human protection because they're still vulnerable to predators. But during the day, they spend out in the bush with intermingling with older wild elephants. And those elephants, many of whom have passed through their program but are now living wild, really adopt them. And it's sort of a handoff where once the elephants are large enough, the other elephants come and they take over from
take
the people.
Take over.
And then there's several years where they work together. It's just extraordinary to see. It's the sort of thing if someone told you about it, you really wouldn't quite believe it. But once you see it, it really changes, your whole perspective on the natural world.
And the idea of caring for these baby elephants happens because the parents have been killed for usually their ivory.
Unfortunately, yes, the poaching for ivory and is increasing in today's world with the demand in the Far East increasing. Human-related tragedies, wells dug in dry riverbeds for the cattle of pastoral people. The elephants fall in, the cattle come, the elephant herd has to leave and abandon the baby. So they're all human-related misfortunes. And those that come in older, of course, are very, very fearful of humans because there's no reason why elephants should think kindly about humans, which is a great sadness, I think.
So what you have to do initially is work to gain their trust.
They're terribly fragile, so they come in a mess. They're psychologically disturbed. Most of them just want to die. They don't even want to try to live. So you've got to turn that round very rapidly with a lot of tender, loving care. You've got to stabilize the stomach, and then the healing process begins. And the keepers work very intensively with the new elephants that come into the nursery. They sleep with them at night. They're with them 24 hours a day. You have to keep the temperature stable, have to stabilize the stomach, because any sort of upset like diarrhea or something like that, they will dehydrate literally within hours. And an elephant baby can be fine one day and dead the next. They're terribly fragile.
How much do they weigh when they come to you?
Well, they come all in different shapes and sizes. Elephants are born big and small, just like human babies. But the average weight of a newborn elephant is about between 220 and 250 pounds. That's
and how are they found? Do they don't just wander in?
No. It's like the ones that are saved. It's a needle in a haystack. We do a lot of community outreach work amongst the pastoral people and that share land with wild elephants. And that message is getting out. So often they're found by tribesmen who then contact the Wildlife Service. And we're then contacted by the Wildlife Service. We then have to charter a plane, because the babies would never survive a car journey. So the calf has to be taken to the nearest airfield, sometimes in the far corners of the country, and then it's a plane ride back to the nursery, and then our work really begins.
Drew, I saw in the film you did one of these babies being loaded onto a plane. My goodness. The amount of energy to lift this little thing, not so little, onto a two-wing plane, pretty amazing.
It's incredible. I mean, I think there was about 10 guys just trying to lift it, up over their heads to put him in the airplane. It's very, very difficult. The whole rescue operation of that elephant was very dramatic because that elephant had been protected, sort of found by bull elephants. It had lost its mother and was found by a different group of bulls, and they were protecting him, but they can't feed him. So even though he was among other elephants, if he wasn't rescued, he would have been dead within a couple days.
So he was starving, literally starving, and that's something I want to ask you about, Dame Daphne, because you had to work so long to get just the right formula of milk.
Yes, of course, newborn elephants didn't come in every day. But with everyone that came in, we learned a little more. We found out that they were totally intolerant to the fat in cow's milk, that they had to have a fat-free cow's milk, fat-free base. And the nearest thing to the fat in elephant's milk is actually coconut. It took me 28 years to actually get the formula right, but it's not just the milk formula. It's also the husbandry, the care, to replace what that elephant would have enjoyed with its own family. And that's constant companionship, lots of tender, loving care. They're very tactile animals. Their keepers are encouraged to touch them, to talk to them, to be with them all night and day for the first 2 years in the nursery.
Tell me about your first encounter, Drew, with a baby elephant.
It was pretty spectacular because for me the first time was I just came to visit Dame Daphne in a real exploratory visit for this film. And my only intention was to come and say hello and speak with her for a little bit, just, you know, pay my respects. And, you know, she, you know, we went, we had a short meeting and probably a cup of tea. And she said, would you like to go walk with the elephants? And I'm like, really? So then I actually spent the afternoon out with probably this group of 10, you know, baby elephants and their keepers wandering through the bush. And it was just, I just felt like I was transported into another world, you know. And it is another world because out in the wild, there's certainly not 10 little baby elephants walking around together. You know, there's, you know, there's a big family and there's, you know, big ones and little ones. But this is this very, you know, special little place. It's like a nursery school for elephants. And to be spend your afternoon, you know, kicking a ball around and just walking in the forest with all these precious little elephants was extraordinary. You know, one thing that's quite interesting is they enjoy suckling on your fingers the way a, you know, child likes to suck his thumb or have a pacifier.
Drew Feldman, he's writer and producer of Born to Be Wild 3D. It opens nationwide April 8th. And here in the studio with me, Dame Daphne Sheldrick. She's a Kenyan author, conservationist, the first person to have perfected the milk formula and necessary husbandry for both infant milk-dependent elephants and rhinos. She's also an expert in the raising and reintegrating of orphaned elephants into the wild. She's done that now for over 30 years. Drew Feldman, he's a writer and producer of a new film opening nationally this Friday. It's titled Born to Be Wild 3D. Here in Washington, it will be at the IMAX Theater, and you will see it in all its glory. Dame Daphne, you said during the break that you almost feel that red dirt that the elephants dust in. Why do they cover themselves that way?
Well, the mud is very important to elephants. It protects the skin. It's good for the skin, protects them from the sun and biting flies. And it's just like taking a mud bath instead of the sort of bath we have. And then after that, a dusting with talcum powder. In this case, it's red earth.
Red dirt.
Yeah.
Why have you reached a point of covering them in coconut oil to protect themselves, especially their ears, what would they do in the wild?
Well, a newborn elephant is kept underneath its mother, surrounded by the family, so it's protected from the sun, the wind, and the rain. And that's sunblock that is being put on the ears of that baby in the IMAX film. And we also have to use an umbrella if the baby is very, very small. Otherwise, you will see amongst those orphans, some of them have ears that have been disfigured. That's from sunburn.
So their skin is that fragile.
Very, very fragile. In early infancy, they kept beneath the mother for the first 2 years of life. And it's very important when they're newborn to protect the ears and the soft skin on the back.
Drew Feltman, you said you went for this walk with Dame Daphne and she introduced you to some of these baby elephants. I'm told that elephants never forget. So how did you introduce yourself to your first baby elephant friend?
Well, the introduction is actually the best part of the experience because the elephants will come up to you and offer their trunk. They want you to blow in their trunk.
Blow.
Yes.
Just and then, blow.
That's right, like a tuba. And then they, you know, will then understand who you are. Is that... That's what I've been told. Is that true?
Yeah, so when elephants greet one another, they put the trunk in each other's mouth. It's a typical elephant greeting. Well, of course, you know, you can't take the trunk into a human mouth, so the best thing is just to blow into it.
And they
don't offer
forget.
Their trunk. Yes. Right.
So that was a pretty incredible experience. And then the next time I came, that one particular elephant that I met had already moved on to the next stage of the project and was living in Tsavo. And I saw that elephant there. About a group of eight of them were walking by. That one, just as they were passing me, split off from the group and came right over to me and gave me her trunk again.
Wow.
So whether or not she recognized me or knew me, I have no idea, but it was pretty amazing. And I hadn't met any of the other ones
because they were a little bit older.
But I just thought it was interesting coincidence that the only one that I had met came right over to me. It was pretty interesting.
I was amazed that you have one person for one elephant.
No, it's not actually like that. We actually have 54 trained elephant keepers. We don't encourage the elephants to become too fond of any one person.
I see. So they rotate.
There'll be a different keeper sleeping with a different elephant every night in the nursery. The keepers will go with them to the rehab stations, and they will be rotated around all three of our facilities so that all the elephants know all the men that are the elephant family, the surrogate one, and all the men know all the elephants. So when the keepers meet some of the elephants that are now ex-orphans, the bigger ones that are now living wild, the greeting with their human keepers is very, very touching indeed. They will come and greet them and remember. And one of our early matriarchs recognized a man she hadn't seen for over 35 years.
Oh, my goodness.
But, so they really don't forget.
Right. And when you say that the elephants sleep with a keeper, you really mean that.
I really do. In each little stable, there's straw on the floor. There's a mattress for the elephant to lie on and a blanket to put over it when it's asleep. The keeper will be with it on the straw.
All night
on another
long.
Mattress right beside it with his hand on the elephant, comforting it, touching it throughout the night. And as the elephant grows and becomes used to his presence, so the keeper can be elevated a little and sleep on a platform just above the elephant, but still in contact with him or with the elephant. So the elephant knows that the keeper's there at all times.
And hears the breathing and feels that presence.
That's in the nursery. But when they go to the rehab stations, then there's a change. All the orphans are in a big stockade together at night without the keepers. But the keepers are very nearby. So that if they're afraid and trumpet or cry in the night because the lions are around, the keepers will come to them. But they will have each other. And so that's the beginning of the formation of a sort of herd of orphans. And then the ones that are now living wild come back to greet the ones that are still based in the stockades at night, introduce themselves, love them, welcome into the family, just as you saw in the IMAX film.
Give me a sense of how long each baby elephant stays with his or her keeper before moving on to that intermediate stage.
Yes, one has to understand that at any age, an elephant duplicates a human of exactly the same age. So they're infants, certainly for the first 5 years of life, where they need supplementary feeding and help and milk for the first three, and then they're juveniles until they reach puberty between 10 and 12. They're not grown until they're 20. And the reintegration of the elephants is in their own time, at their own pace. And they decide when it's time to actually leave the human family and become elephants again.
How do you know? How do you know?
We don't. The elephants themselves decide, and the ones that are now living wild sometimes make that decision. They will come back to the stockade and take one of the bigger ones that's almost ready to join them and take him out, him or her out for a night's outing into the bush. Now, often that little elephant, bearing in mind that elephants have limited vision at night, they're like us, they don't see in the dark too well, might get very fearful because they're very fearful animals by nature. And then the matriarch, who's now living wild, will order two of the young bulls to escort that baby back to the keepers, and it'll be taken back into the stockades. And sometimes the ones that are living wild will want to have a more peaceful night back in the stockades, and they come back home and they'll be with the junior group again. So we call the stockade-based ones the juniors, and the ones that are living wild are the seniors.
Wow. Have you seen all of this, Drew?
Absolutely. And yeah, we were even told to expect it, but you can't
imagine,
quite believe it until you see it with your own eyes, and then it really, really blows you away.
It hits home.
I mean, the amazing thing is that when we, in the film, we film the transfer of these three baby elephants out to the halfway house. And even just before they arrived, like an hour or so before they arrived, out of the bush came two groups of each about, 12 or 14 elephants.
Ready to receive.
Large elephants, 10, 12 years old, all sort of graduates of the program, the seniors that Dame Daphne's talking about, who are now living wild. And they came to greet the babies even before they arrived. And so the question is, well, how do they even know they're coming? And it's one of those just unanswerable mysteries.
It's a mystery. They have amazing perception. And this is something that can never be actually proved scientifically. It's impossible to do it. But they can predict events in a most mysterious way. And when you raise the elephants and you're with them every day, through infancy, through adulthood, into adulthood and beyond, because they then keep in touch with the ones that are still stockade-based and they like to return and see their keepers from time to time, you learn so much about the inside story of elephants and their wonderful animals.
Dame Daphne Sheldrake and Drew Feldman. He's writer and producer of Born to be Wild 3D, which opens this weekend nationally here in Washington at the IMAX Theater. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Tricia in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
During the 20 years that I lived in Mexico, every August I'd go to Africa. And I always had a driver. And once we were in Tanzania, and we found this elephant suffering with that had been speared, and the tusks were cut off. So we went several places to ask rangers to help us, to put it out of its misery. And finally, Charles, my driver, said, the WWO is the only one that really helps. And that's World Wildlife Fund. And when I lived in Washington 20 years, I'm a member. And I know that they helped in Africa. We went there, and immediately one of the people came with us and put the elephant out of the misery.
What a sad story.
That is a sad story. We've rescued many elephants, one of which had a spear 10 inches embedded into her skull, had been chopped with axes on the back. That elephant was very difficult to calm down, very difficult to tame, having had such a terrible experience at the hands of humans. But I'm happy to tell you it's a very happy story. She's now absolutely wonderful. She's in the nursery still. We'll be going to the rehab station very shortly. She's an elephant called Merca.
And how old would you say she is?
She's over 2 years old now. She came to us when she was almost two. We've healed her and stabilized her psychologically. She's now ready to take the next step. And
why would someone have tried to take her life at such a young age?
Unfortunately, some of the pastoral Maasai people have been grazing illegally in Tsavo National Park, and the intrusion of livestock in the park is one of the things that's threatening the wild elephants. And when the Wildlife Service tries to eject these cattle that are grazing illegally in the park, some of the tribesmen take revenge on the elephants. And the mother was obviously killed, her ivory tusks stolen. The baby was with its mother, and because she was nearly 2 years old, obviously being quite a pain to the executioners. And so they did that to her.
Dame Daphne Sheldrick, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Judy.
Morning. I'm kind of crying.
Oh.
Sorry, but I'm just so happy to know that this is the subject that's on your show today. I love elephants, and I really want to thank her for treating them so kindly and doing what she's doing.
Well, I would like to thank the public, too, for helping us doing what we're doing. Anyone can foster a baby elephant through our website, and that's how – so, you know, it's a joint effort.
Give me that website.
www.sheldrickwildlifetrust.org.
And we'll have that on our website so that those who'd like to make a contribution – can do so. Judy, you're not the only one who is crying when I saw that film. I found myself absolutely moved to tears. It's just an extraordinary story. They say that too often we as humans begin to anthropomorphize animals, and yet what you're doing, what you're learning about these elephants would indicate they're as human as we are, Drew.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no reason to anthropomorphize animals in order to acknowledge their emotions and feelings. You know, I mean, you spend any amount of time with these orangutans and elephants and you understand very, very quickly how emotionally sophisticated they are.
Talk about the orangutans.
Sure. Well, you know, half of this film, you know, features the work of Dr. Caldicott, and, you know, she's been out there for 40 years in Borneo studying wild orangutans and then, you know, raising orphans. What happens out there is a lot of the jungle, rainforest jungle habitat is clear cut for palm oil plantations. And in a way, the orangutans are really collateral damage of that. They don't have the financial value that an elephant has as far as their, you know, tusks. They're not a resource. They're really collateral damage because the forest is cut down and burned. And so their whole habitat is destroyed.
And where do they go?
Well, often they're killed. And then sometimes they'll go into the palm plantations that have replaced their home, you know, because they're starving, and they'll eat the palm fruit, and then they'll be killed for doing that. So it's just really terrible injustice.
And what has the individual in the film been able to do with those poor orangutans?
Sure. Well, it's quite similar to the, you know, to Dame Daphne's project in a way, in that they take them as infants, and it's about it's like an 8-year process until they're then able to, you know, return to the wild. Because one, again, their stages of life also mirror human stages of life, and they're too immature until they're about 8 years old to take care of themselves. And also, that's about the age that an orangutan will normally leave its mother. And until then, they're really too small to take care of themselves. They don't have the knowledge. They're still can, you know, become prey for clouded leopards or, you know, other predators in the jungle.
Here's an email. We're getting lots of emails from people who have visited the Sheldrick Foundation and would like to thank you, Dame Daphne, for your work. One caller said she just received a birthday gift, which is to foster one of these elephants.
Fantastic. Which one?
I don't know. They haven't told me, but if I get a name, I shall give it to you. All right, we're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more of your phone calls, your emails for Drew Feldman, writer and producer of Born to Be Wild 3D, and Dr. Dame Daphne Sheldrick.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. By Cabot Creamery Cooperative, 5 generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the smallpox epidemic at the turn of the 20th century and the civil liberties questions raised by how the government enforced mandatory vaccinations.
There were scenes of policemen holding down men in their night robes, and inspectors were going room to room looking for children with smallpox.
We'll talk with Michael Woolrich, author of Pox.
Right back to the phones to Jim in Zanesville, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Hello. My comment was, or I wanted to know if your panelists could possibly comment on the hunting of the elephants in Africa. What I've been told is that they don't hold any value to the local population if they're not hunted, and the money that comes in from the professional hunters helps to put some value on the elephants, and they're protected from the poaching and other problems. Could they possibly give us some information on alternatives that people with the wherewithal, the money to spend on something other than killing the elephants to help the elephants?
All right. All right, Dame Daphne.
Yes, hunting has been banned in Kenya since 1974. I personally cannot understand how anyone can, with all conscience, get pleasure out of killing an elephant. The elephants are far more valuable to the habitat than they are in terms of meat and trophies. Tourism is Kenya's biggest revenue earner, and the elephants are needed for that. They are the key to many wildlife habitats. They create the pathways through the thickets. They seal the water holes and provide water for all. And, you know, they are absolutely crucial to wild environments. Now, elephants are human. They're human animals. They have all the emotions of a human. I don't think there's any human that would like their family killed just for the value of its meat or anything. And I don't think elephants should be killed either. I think they should be protected. Now, I do understand that humans have intruded onto elephant habitats and cut migration routes that elephants have used for throughout millennia. And now the elephants are problem animals, and some of them have to be shot, of course, when they're destroying crops, because an elephant can destroy a man's crops overnight. But there are alternatives. People that live in these places can electrically fence themselves in. Their elephant corridors are being created through wildlife habitats, because elephants need space, just like us. They need to visit their friends and family that are living in far-off places. And so there are alternatives being investigated in Kenya to try and save the elephants, which are a very, very valuable resource for the country and for nature as a whole.
Thanks.
I don't believe that humans can live in isolation. We need the natural world.
Thanks for calling, Jim. Here's a question for you, Drew, from Maureen, who says, my 7-year-old daughter loves elephants. Will this film be appropriate for her? Also, are there volunteer opportunities available for children and family? First, the film.
Sure. I mean, this film is absolutely appropriate. It's really a film for kids. And, you know, there are a lot of films out there in the world about wildlife and the dangers that wildlife face that are grim, you know, where, you know, you shed tears, but they're tears of sorrow, you know. For us, we wanted to make a film that, you know, explored the joys of being a young orangutan, the joys of being a young elephant, and to, you know, help everybody see how miraculous these animals are by, you know, loving them as opposed to, you know, pitying them. So I think, you know, kids are really responding well to this movie, and definitely take all small children.
Exactly. And what about volunteer opportunities?
We would absolutely love to have as many volunteers as possible, but actually it's not possible. First of all, the keepers that are with the elephants have to have a long-term commitment. They've got to be with those animals for 10 years.
Wow.
Day and night for 2 years in the nursery and beyond that. And also, there is a lot of unemployment and poverty in Kenya, and the government does not encourage foreigners to take a position that could be filled by a local Kenyan that would at least keep him or her off the streets. So we the only voluntary help we can accept is occasionally to help at our little shop table during the mud bath hour, just for 1 hour a day, but not they're not allowed to actually work with the elephants.
All right, let's go to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Alfredo. You're on the air.
Yes, I had a question. It was similar to Maureen's. I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I also wanted to take her to see the film. She hasn't, she's 3.5, and she hasn't really seen, been to the movies at all. And I didn't want to take her to the animated films that are out now, Hop, or which is animation and live action, and Rango, which is also about animals. And
yeah, and the question is, again, for a 3.5-year-old, even in 3D, do you feel this appropriate?
Well, I would say as far as the subject matter is concerned, I feel it's very appropriate. Unfortunately, because it's in 3D and it requires wearing those glasses and keeping your head straight, I think 3 is a bit young. I think 4 or 5 is a much, you know, better age. But that said, there are many IMAX theaters where the film will be playing in 2D. I don't know exactly off the top of my head which ones those are.
So if you were to watch this movie at 3D, you'd have to wear the glasses,
right,
or else it
would
be
and that's
be
very hard for a 3-year-old.
Yeah, I would agree. Okay, so let's say 4.5 to 5.
I think that's the right age.
All right, to Wilmington, North Carolina. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I'm in a rainstorm, so I apologize for the background noise, but thank you, Diane. It's an interesting conversation.
Good.
And Drew, I'm looking forward to seeing your film.
Thanks.
And Dame Daphne, I want to thank you for your dedication, for your life work. And I have a quick question, but I'll follow with a quick little story. I remember a documentary in Los Angeles of a keeper in a zoo who was retired and went back to the zoo to be reunited with an elephant there. And after 30 years of absence, the elephant came over, put the trunk around his friend, the keeper, and they both were they were crying after
wow.
his absence. So my question is what is your emotional connection with the elephants and vice versa? Because that's really the element, I think, the connection with these special animals. How do you feel, or how hard is it to let an elephant go?
When you're raising the elephants, it's a very emotional roller coaster. You have to take the rough with the smooth. And there are many times that you might feel like throwing in the towel and, oh, I can't go on doing this.
Give but me then an example.
When a baby elephant that you've worked so hard on just suddenly dies.
Mm.
But you have to turn the corner and know that there are lots of others that need your help and get on with the job.
Is it because some come to you with such deprivation to begin with that you simply cannot bring them to a state of health?
Yes, you know, they come to us in a real mess, most of them, almost close to death.
Ah.
And they're also all different individuals. You know, some have a much more will to want to live, particularly the bulls. The little girls are very, very emotionally distraught, mm-hmm. having lost their elephant family. So those are more difficult to actually turn around.
Here's a website comment from Kate. She says, I have followed Dame Daphne since I first saw her 60 Minutes years ago and vowed if I ever got to Kenya, I would go see her. I made the pilgrimage in 2004 and again in 2006 and was so moved to see her elephant orphanage. It was life-changing for me. I gave my niece and nephew a present of adopting one of the elephants I saw. This changed their life as they got weekly emails from the Sheldrick Foundation and cared about their elephant. Do you keep that up?
Yes, we do. Every foster parent receives the keeper's diary every month. The diary comes to me in broken English and Swahili from the keepers, who document on a daily basis exactly what the orphans are doing and who comes back to visit and who's friends of who and so on. And that goes into the website every month at month's end, along with updated pictures of the orphans and a special thing for the foster parents, a picture done by my very talented daughter.
How wonderful. To Pinehurst, North Carolina. Good morning, Linda.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
Surely.
And thank you both so much for this. And Drew, thank you for making a movie that's going to be appropriate for my kindergarten. I hope you're going to love it. Dame Daphne, I just wanted to know, is there any particular reason that mother elephants couldn't foster the infant elephants that they wouldn't take over their care?
There is, in that an infant elephant needs milk for 3 years, and a mother elephant, you know, if she's lactating, will probably have her own baby. Now, she certainly won't want to jeopardize the survival of her own calf be able to feed two, and she will not have enough milk to feed two. But sometimes it does happen, for instance, with our orphan called Edo from Amboseli National Reserve. He was actually... he could suckle his grandmother when she had a calf. But the daughter, who also had a calf, when the grandmother died, the daughter would not let Edo suckle her. And then he became an orphan. Edo today is a bull in almost 20 years old, living wild, And so he's has a happy end to his story. But it must break the elephant's heart not to be able to take over the babies that are orphaned.
Gosh, what a story. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland, and to Kat. Good morning.
Good morning. Earlier when you were talking about the elephants coming to the compound or whatever before the babies arrived, it reminded me of a researcher, The Secret Language of Elephants, about them actually being able to hear the sounds over miles. And I was wondering if maybe that was the reason that they were able to show up before the babies got there. And also was wondering if you'd seen any evidence of some kind of communication that we simply can't hear because it's on such a low frequency.
We see the communication of infrasound beyond our hearing range every single day in the rehabilitation stations, where the ex-orphans will be at a certain point way out in the bush. The keepers have no idea where they are, and suddenly the little orphans that are keeper-dependent will head out into the bush, followed by the keepers. The keepers then follow the elephants, and they will meet up at a point deep in the bush. And this is the infrasound communication.
Ah.
But I also believe that elephants communicate telepathically too. We've had evidence of that as well.
Like what?
When we're moving the babies from the nursery to the halfway house, on one occasion, we weren't able to inform the keepers at the halfway house that the elephants were coming on that particular day. There'd been a change in plans, and you can't get signal easily at the halfway house. And so the elephants were on their way. The keepers at the halfway house had no idea they were on their way until they were almost there. Now, none of those big elephants who are now ex-orphans knew the little ones that were coming. They hadn't shared nursery time with them, but yet they knew that some elephants would be arriving that day, and they were in the compound waiting for them. And the keepers couldn't understand why suddenly the ex-orphans returned and the little ones wouldn't leave the compound until suddenly they get a signal from the lorry carrying these baby elephants to the compound that we're about to arrive in an hour's time.
Extraordinary story, Dr. Dame Daphne Sheldrick, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Dan in Elliott, Maine. Good morning, Dan.
Hi, Diane, and thank you so much for this great show.
Sure.
Some years ago, I read an article in the New York Times magazine that moved me quite deeply about marauding elephants in Africa, young bulls, I think. And the rationale, the explanation was that their mothers had been murdered by poachers and that they were left without the family structure that was so important to their growth. And there was a comparison, I think, made to young men who without family structures and as an explanation for why they were troublesome in their communities. And that story always stuck with me, and I'm wondering if there's ways to address some of the problems associated with these grown-up or, say, adolescent elephants that have been set adrift from their families because of poaching.
I know the what you're talking about. Those elephants were orphaned during a cull in South Africa, not murdered by poachers, but murdered by the people that are supposed to be protecting them. And they saw their family butchered in front of their eyes, all immobilized and shot and cut up in front of their eyes. They were taken as orphans to be sold in circuses and zoos. And I actually fought for those elephants. We were 5 weeks fighting a court case down in Pretoria to save those elephants. And a lot of them were sent to a little private sanctuary that had enough space for a few elephants, but they behaved very badly. They were psychologically disturbed, distraught, post-traumatic stress and all that set in because they're very human emotionally. And it wasn't until they brought some adult elephants in to give them guidance and comfort them and heal them and teach them how to behave. Because in an animal that lives 70 years, there's also a lot of learning that has to happen, and that's passed on from the adults, just as our own children need adult supervision in their growing years.
I have two final comments for you, one from our website, from Jan, who says, my son spent his fourth birthday watching your staff feed the baby elephants. This so impressed him that he gave his own money to foster Kenzie. He continues to give willingly his own money to your foundation and enjoys the monthly updates you send out. And finally, a Facebook comment from Avery. This is an incredible and inspiring story. Always wonderful to know there are people out there who are doing things like this. Thank you so much, Dame Daphne, for your work.
Thank all of you for your support.
And also to Drew Feldman for your film, which opens this Friday. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.